third, Gerling resumed, I know there are far more members of the Coruscantian priesthood who share my view of the state of Mother Church's soul than anyone in the temple or in Zion has ever dreamed. I'm sure I need hardly tell you this, after what you've seen in Karis, and in Emerald, and in Chisholm, yet I think it deserves to be stated anyway. The group of four, and the vicarate as a whole, have made the serious, serious error of assuming that if they can suppress internal voices of criticism, if they can use the power of the Inquisition to repress demands for reform, then those voices and those demands have no strength, pose no threat. Unfortunately for them, they're wrong. And there are pastors in this very city who prove my point. Bishop Kaisi is already aware of several of them, but I hope, my lord, you'll take the opportunity to attend Mass at St. Catherine soon. I think you'll hear a voice you recognize in Father Timon's. I hope, however, that you'll also recognize that what you're hearing is a Coruscantian voice, not that of a man who considers himself a Carizian. He paused once more, raising one eyebrow, and Adamson nodded again more firmly. A valid distinction, and one I'll strive to bear in mind, the bishop acknowledged. On the other hand, I scarcely thought of myself as a Carizian when all of this began. I imagine that, in the fullness of time, your Father Timon may actually make something of the same transition on his own terms. He may, my lord. Gerling's tone conveyed something less than confidence in that particular transition, and he grimaced. I'll be honest, the Archbishop went on, and admit that the sticking point for quite a few Coruscantians is the assassination of Prince Hector and the Crown Prince. Whatever his faults from the perspective of other princedoms, and I'm probably more aware of them than the vast majority of Coruscantians, Prince Hector was both respected and popular here in Coruscant. Many of his subjects, especially here in the capital, bitterly resent his murder, and the fact that the Church of Karis hasn't condemned Caleb for it makes the Church, in turn, suspect in their eyes. And to be brutally honest, it's a point upon which those trying to organize opposition to both the Church and the Empire are playing with considerable success. The Church, Adamson said, and for the first time there was a hard, cold edge in his voice, hasn't condemned Emperor Caleb for the murder of Prince Hector because the Church doesn't believe he was responsible for it. Obviously, condemning the rulers of the Church's sole secular protector for an act of cold-blooded murder would be politically very difficult and dangerous. Nonetheless, I give you my personal assurance that Archbishop Michael and I genuinely and sincerely believe the Emperor had nothing at all to do with Prince Hector's assassination. If for no other reason than because it would have been so incredibly stupid for him to have done anything of the sort. In fact, he closed his mouth with an almost audible snap and made an angry, brushing-away gesture before he sat back, firmly, in his armchair. The office was very still and quiet for several seconds, until, finally, Gerling stirred behind his desk. "If you'll recall, my lord," he said, and his tone was oddly calm, almost mild, considering what had just passed between him and Adamson. "I said I had four primary reasons for accepting this office. I fully realize that what you were about to say, what you stopped yourself from saying because you realized how self-serving it would sound, is that you believe it was Mother Church who had Prince Hector killed." Adamson seemed to stiffen in his chair, but Gerling met his gaze levelly, holding him in place. "I do not believe Mother Church ordered Prince Hector's murder," the Archbishop of Coruscant said, very, very quietly, his eyes never wavering from Adamson's. "But neither do I believe it was Emperor Caleb. And that, my lord, is the fourth reason I accepted this office." Because you believe that from it you'll be in a position to help discover who did order it? Adamson asked. Oh, no, my lord. Gerling shook his head, his expression grim, and made the confession he'd never intended to make when these two men walked into his office. I said I don't believe Mother Church had Prince Hector killed. That, however, is because I'm morally certain in my own mind who did. Adamson's eyes widened, and Gerling smiled without humor. I don't believe it was Mother Church, but I do believe it was Mother Church's Grand Inquisitor, he said softly.
You do?
Despite all of his formidable self-control and all of his years of experience, Adamson couldn't quite keep the surprise out of his voice, and Gerling's thin smile grew ever so slightly wider, without becoming a single degree warmer. Like you, my lord, I can imagine nothing stupider Caleb could possibly have done, and the young man I met here in Manchir is anything but stupid. And when I consider all the other possible candidates, one name suggests itself inescapably to me. Unlike the vast majority of the people here in Coruscant, I've actually met Vicar Jaspar. May I assume you've done the same? Adamson nodded, and Gerling shrugged. In that case, I'm sure you'll understand when I say that if there is one man in Zion who is simultaneously more prepared than Jaspar Clinton to embrace expediency, more certain his own prejudices accurately reflect God's will, and more confident his intellect far surpasses that of any other mortal man, I have no idea who he might be. Prince Hector's murder, his instant transformation from one more warring prince to a martyr of Mother Church, would strike Clinton as a maneuver with absolutely no disadvantages, and I'm as certain as I'm sitting here that he personally ordered the assassinations. I can't prove it, not yet. In fact, I think it's probable no one will ever be able to prove it, and even if someday I could, it wouldn't suddenly make the notion of being subordinated to Corisian control magically palatable to Coruscantians. But knowing what I know of the man, believing what I believe about what he's already done, and what that implies about what he's prepared to do in the future, I had no choice but to oppose him. In that respect, at least, I'm as loyal a son of the Church of Caris as any man on the face of the world. Gerald Adamson sat back once more, regarding him for several silent moments, then shrugged. Your Eminence, that's precisely the point at which I began my own spiritual journey, so I'm scarcely in a position to criticize you for doing the same thing. And as far as the Church of Caris is concerned, I think you'll find Archbishop Michael is perfectly prepared to accept that starting point in anyone, even if it should transpire that you never reach the same destination I have. The difference between him and Jaspar Clinton doesn't have anything to do with their confidence they'll someday reach God's goals. Neither one of them is ever going to waver in that belief, that determination. The difference is that Clinton is prepared to do whatever he must to reach the goal he's dictated to God, while Archbishop Michael trusts God to reach whatever goal he desires. And the bishop's eyes warmed. If you can actually meet Archbishop Michael, spend a 5-day or two in his presence, and not discover that any church he's responsible for building is worthy of your wholehearted support, then you'll be the first person I've met who can do that. 3. Royal Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey sighed with relief as he entered the palace's heat-shedding bulk and got out of the direct path of the sun's ferocity. November was always warm in Manchir, but this November seemed determined to set a new standard. which we don't exactly need on top of everything else, he thought, as he strode briskly down the hall. Langhorn knows we've got enough other things generating warmth all over the damned princedom. Indeed they did, and Garvai was, unfortunately, in a far better position to appreciate that minor fact than he might have preferred. The guards standing outside the council chamber door came to attention at his approach, and he nodded back, acknowledging the military courtesy. He recognized both of them. They'd been part of his headquarters detachment before that unpleasantness at Talbor Pass, which was the main reason they'd been chosen for their present duty. Just at the moment, the number of people he could trust behind him with a weapon was limited, to say the least, he thought, as he passed through the garden door. "Sorry I'm late," he said as his father looked up from a conversation with Earl Tartarian. "Alec's latest report arrived just as I was getting ready to leave my office."
"Don't worry about it," his father said just a bit sourly. "You haven't really missed much, since it's not like we've managed to accomplish a whole hell of a lot so far today."
Garvai wished the sourness in that response could have come as a surprise, but Sir Rysel Garvai, the Earl of Anvil Rock, had a lot to feel sour about. As the senior of the two designated co-regents for Prince Divan, he'd wound up head of the prince's regency council, which had to be the most thankless task in the entire princedom. Well, probably aside from Sir Corin Garvai's new assignment, that was. If there were six nobles in the entire princedom who genuinely believed Anvil Rock hadn't cut some sort of personal deal with Caleb Armagh, Garvai didn't have a clue who they might be. Aside from Tartarian, who was probably as thoroughly detested these days as Anvil Rock himself, Garvai could think of exactly three of the deceased Prince Hector's counselors who genuinely believed Anvil Rock and Tartarian weren't solely out for themselves. Fortunately, Sir Raymond Lindar, who continued to serve as the Keeper of the Purse, was one of those three. The other two, Edwer Garthen, the Earl of North Coast, and Truman Southman, the Earl of Aerith, had both agreed to serve on the Regency Council as well, although with a marked lack of enthusiasm on North Coast's part, because they'd realized someone had to do it. Archbishop Claremont Gerling, whose position automatically made him a member of the council as well, appeared to agree with North Coast and Aerith where Anvil Rock and Tartarian were concerned, but he'd never been one of Hector's counselors. The council's final two members, the Duke of Margot and the Earl of Craggy Hill, neither of whom were present at the moment, had held positions on Hector's council and shared the rest of the nobility's general suspicion about Anvil Rock's and Tartarian's motives to the full. "Not having them here today isn't going to make them any happier when they find out about this meeting either," Garvai thought, as he walked across to his own place at the circular council table. "On the other hand, I can't think of anything that would make them happy." Sir Berriman Chalmare, the Duke of Margot, was the Regency Council's highest-ranking nobleman. He'd also been a distant, very distant, cousin of Prince Hector, and it probably wasn't too surprising that he resented having a mere earl as Divan's regent instead of himself. Wallace Hillkeeper, the Earl of Craggy Hill, on the other hand, was quite a different breed of kraken. It was entirely possible Margot nursed a few ambitions of his own under the circumstances. Garvai didn't think he did, but he well might, and not without at least some justification, given the current irregular circumstances. Yet if there was an edge of doubt about him in Garvai's mind, there was none at all about Craggy Hill. The Earl's ambition was far more poorly hidden than he obviously thought it was, despite the fact that, unlike Margot, he possessed not even a shred of a claim on the crown. The good news was that the two of them were outnumbered 6-2 whenever it came down to a vote. The bad news was that their very inability to influence the council's decisions had only driven them closer together. Worse, one of them, at least one of them, was leaking his own version of the council's deliberations to outside ears. Which probably explains why Father didn't make any particular effort to get the two of them here today, Garvey reflected. Actually, Rysel, saying we haven't accomplished anything today isn't entirely fair, Tartarian said in a rather milder tone.
Oh, forgive me, Anvil Rock rolled his eyes. So far we've managed to agree on how big a stipend to set aside for Diven from his own income. Of course we haven't figured out how we're going to get it to him, but I'm sure we'll come up with something eventually.
I realize you're probably even more worn out with all of this than I am, Tartarian said, and I don't blame you either. But the truth is that we've at least managed to handle the correspondence from General Cherman.
Handle? Anvil Rock repeated. Just exactly how did we handle that, Terrell? If I recall correctly, it was more a matter of getting our marching orders than handling anything.
Obviously, Garvey thought, his father was in one of his moods, not surprisingly.
I'd scarcely call them marching orders, Tartarian replied calmly. And neither would you if you weren't so busy pitching a snit.
Anvil Rock's eyes opened wide. He started to shoot something back, then visibly made himself pause.
All right, he conceded grudgingly. Fair enough. I'll try to stop venting my spleen.
A little venting is perfectly all right with us, Rysel, Lindar told him with a slight smile. It's not as if the rest of us don't feel exactly the same way from time to time. Still, Terrell has a point. From my read, the Viceroy General...
It was clear to Garvey that Lindar had used Sherman's official title deliberately.
Is still doing his best to avoid stepping on us any harder than he has to.
Anvil Rock looked as if he would have liked to dispute that analysis. Instead, he nodded.
I have to admit he's at least taking pains to be courteous, he said. And truth to tell, I appreciate it. But the unfortunate fact, Raymond, is that he's not telling us anything we don't know. And the even more unfortunate fact is that, at the moment... I don't see a damned thing we can do about it.
He looked around the table, as if inviting suggestions from his fellows. None, however, seemed to be forthcoming, and he snorted sourly.
May I assume the Viceroy General was expressing his concern over the latest incidents?
Garvey asked after a moment, and his father nodded.
That's exactly what he was doing, and I don't blame him, really. In fact, if I were in his position, I'd probably be doing more than just expressing concern by this point.
Garvey nodded soberly. Given the white-hot tide of fury which had swept Coruscant following Prince Hector's assassination, it wasn't surprising the princedom seethed with resentment and hatred. Nor was it especially surprising that the resentment and hatred in question should spill over into public demonstrations, which had a pronounced tendency to slide over into riots. Riots which seemed to be invariably punctuated by looting and arson as well, if the city guard, or, more often than Garvey liked, Cherman's marines didn't get them quenched almost immediately. By an odd turn of fate, the people suffering most frequently from that arson tended to be merchants and shopkeepers, many of whom had been blamed for profiteering and price gouging, once the Carizian blockade of Coruscant had truly begun to bite. Garvey was certain quite a few long-standing private scores, which had damn all to do with loyalty to the House of Dakin, were being settled under cover of those riots, and, for that matter, that some of that arson was intended to destroy records of just who owed what to whom. Although he was in no position to prove anything of the sort, yet, at least. But even if some of the motivation was somewhat less selfless than outraged patriotism and fury over Hector's assassination, there was no denying the genuine anger at Karis's foreign occupation of Coruscant, which was boiling away at the bottom of it. And, inevitable or not, understandable or not, the unrest that anger engendered had equally inevitable consequences of its own. The terms Emperor Caleb had imposed were far less punitive than they could have been, especially in light of the decades of hostility between Karras and Coruscant. All the same, Garvey was certain they were more punitive than Caleb would really have preferred. Unfortunately, the Emperor had been able to read the writing on the wall as clearly as anyone else.
"I agree, Father," he said out loud. "I suppose it's a good thing, under the circumstances, that the Viceroy General recognizes the inevitability of this sort of thing. At least he isn't likely to overreact."
"Yet at least," Northcoast said.
The Earl was a thick-set man, getting a bit thicker through the belly as he settled into middle age. His thinning hair still held a few embers of the fiery red of his youth, and his gray eyes were worried.
"I don't think he's likely to overreact, no matter what happens, my lord," Garvey said frankly. "Unfortunately, if we can't get a handle on this unrest, I think he's going to feel forced to take considerably more forceful steps of his own. Frankly, I don't see that he'll have any choice."
"I have to agree with you, Corin," Earl Aerith said somberly. "But when he does, I'm afraid it's only going to make things worse."
"Which is undoubtedly why he's showing restraint so far," Lindar pointed out.
He shifted in his chair slightly, facing Garvey more squarely.
"Which, in turn, brings us to you, Sir Corin."
"I know," Garvey sighed.
"You said you had a report from Alec?" Anvil Rock asked.
"Yes, in fact, that report is probably the closest thing to good news I've gotten lately. He says his mounted constables are just about ready."
"That is good news," Anvil Rock said, although his feelings were obviously at least somewhat mixed, for which Garvey didn't blame him a bit.
Sir Alec Arthur, the Earl of Windshire, had a reputation as something of a blunt object. A well-deserved reputation, if Garvey was going to be honest about it. He'd been accused, on more than one occasion, of thinking with his spurs, and no dictionary was ever going to use Windshire to illustrate the words "calmly reasoned response." On the other hand, he was aware he wasn't the most brilliant man ever born, and Garvey knew better than most that the impetuous Earl had actually learned to stop and think for, oh, at least 30 or 40 seconds, before charging headlong into the fray. In many ways, he was far from the ideal commander for the mounted patrols about to assume responsibility for maintaining order in the countryside. Yet he had two shining qualifications which outweighed any limitations. First, whatever anyone else might think, the survivors of Garvey's army trusted Windshire as implicitly as they trusted Garvey himself. They knew, whether the rest of the princedom was prepared to believe it or not, that no one could have done a better job under the circumstances than Garvey, Windshire, and Sir Charles Doyle had done. That the combination of the Carisian Marines' rifles, the long range of the Carisian artillery, and the deadly amphibious mobility of the Carisian Navy had been too much for any merely mortal general to overcome. And they knew another commander, other generals, might very well have gotten far more of them killed, proving that. As a consequence, they were willing to continue to trust their old commanders, and that trust, that loyalty, was more precious than rubies. And second, just as important as the troops' trust in Windshire, Garvey had complete faith in the Earl. Perhaps not without a few reservations about Windshire's judgment, he conceded, although he did have rather more confidence in that judgment than some of the Regency Council's members. But whatever reservations he might quietly nurse about the Earl's sagacity, he had complete and total faith in Alec Arthur's loyalty, integrity, and courage. "So maybe he doesn't have the sharpest brain in the princedom to go with them,"
These days, I'll take 3 out of the 4 and thank Langhorn I've got them.
What about the rest of the army, Corin? Tartarian asked.
It could be better, it could be worse, Garvai shrugged. General Cherman's reissued enough muskets for our total permitted force, and we've converted all of them to take the new bayonets. At the moment, we still don't have any artillery, and to be honest, I can't really blame him for that. And all the muskets are still smoothbores. On the other hand, they're a hell of a lot better than anyone else is going to have. That's the could-be-worse side of things. None of the troublemakers we're likely to face are going to have anything like the firepower we do. Unfortunately, I don't have anywhere near as many men as I wish I had. As many as I'm pretty damn sure we're going to need before this is all over, the way things seem to be headed, in fact. And the ones I do have were all trained initially as soldiers, not city guardsmen. Until we actually see them in action, I'm not as confident as I'd like to be that they aren't going to react like combat troops instead of guardsmen, which could get messy. That's the could-be-better side.
How many do you have? Do we have? North Coast asked.
Garvai looked at him and he shrugged.
I know you sent us all a memo about it, and I read it, really I did. But to be honest, I was paying more attention to the naval side of things when I did.
Well, that made sense, Garvai supposed. North Coast's earldom lay on Wind Daughter Island, separated from the main island of Coruscant by East Margot Sound and Whitehorse Reach. Wind Daughter was very nearly half Coruscant Island size, but it boasted less than a quarter as many people. Much of it was still covered in old-growth forest, and 90% of the population lived almost in sight of the water. Wind Daughter's people tended to regard inhabitants of the Big Island as foreigners, and, so far at least, they seemed far less incensed than the citizens of Manchir over Prince Hector's assassination. Under the circumstances, it didn't really surprise Garvai that North Coast had been more concerned over how the Carizian naval patrols were likely to affect his fishermen than over the size of garrison the island might be going to receive. Our total force, field force that is going to be a little under 30,000, he said. I know 30,000 sounds like a lot of men, and, frankly, I'm more than a little amazed that Caleb agreed to let us put that many Coruscantians back under arms at all. But the truth is that it isn't really that big a number, my lord, not when we're talking about something the size of the entire princedom. As long as I can keep them concentrated, they can deal with anything they're likely to face. If I have to start dividing them into smaller forces, though, and I will, just as sure as Shan Wei, the odds start shifting. Frankly, I don't see any way I'm going to be able to put detachments everywhere we're really going to need them. Not if I'm going to keep them big enough, new muskets or not, to make any of us happy. North Coast nodded somberly.
The real problem, Anvil Rock observed, is that we're going to have enough combat power to stomp on any fires that spring up. But we're not going to have enough numbers to give us the sort of coverage that might keep the sparks from flaring up in the first place. He looked unhappy. And the real problem with stomping on fires is that everything else in the vicinity tends to get stomped on as well.
Exactly, Father, which is why I was so glad to see Alex report. I'm going to start deploying his men to the other major towns, especially down here in the southeast, as quickly as possible. He's not going to be able to make any of his detachments as big as we'd all like, but they'll be more mobile than any of our infantry. They'll be able to cover a lot more ground, and frankly, I think cavalry is going to be more reassuring to the local city guardsmen.
Reassuring?
His father smiled thinly.
Don't you mean more intimidating?
To some extent, I suppose I do, Garvai admitted. On the other hand, a little intimidation for the people who'd be most likely to give those guardsmen problems is a good thing. and I'm not going to complain if the constables suggest to the local guard officers that remembering they're supposed to be maintaining public order instead of leading patriotic insurrections would be another good thing.
I'm not either, Anvil Rock said. Even though there's a part of me that would rather be doing exactly that, leading a patriotic insurrection, I mean, instead of what I am doing.
No one responded to that particular remark, and after a moment the Earl shrugged.
All right, Raymond, he said. Now that Corrin has his troops ready to deploy, I suppose it's time we figure out how we're going to pay them, isn't it?
His smile was wintry.
I'm sure that's going to be lots of fun, too.
4. HMS Rockerai 46, Garath Bay, Kingdom of Dolar, and HMS Devastation 54, King's Harbor, Helen Island, Kingdom of Old Karas. The brisk afternoon wind had a wetted edge as it swept across the dark blue waters, ruffling the surface with 2-foot waves. Here and there a crest of white foam broke almost playfully, and the sharp-toothed breeze hummed in the rigging. Garath Bay was a well-sheltered anchorage, and it was always ice-free year-round. But the present air temperature was barely above freezing, and it took very little wind to make a man shiver when it came slicing across the vast, treeless plain of the bay. The Dolaran seamen assembled on the deck of HMS Rockerai were certainly doing their share of shivering as they stood waiting for orders.
Down top gallant masts!
Captain Raisando's voice rang out from the converted merchantman's quarterdeck in the official preparatory order, and petty officers gave their working parties warning glances. Earl Thirsk had decided to grace Rockerai with his presence this afternoon, and it had been made thoroughly clear to everyone aboard that today would be a very bad day to be less than perfect.
Topgallant yardmen in the tops!
Feet thudded across the deck as the designated topmen flooded up the ratlines. They swept up them like monkey lizards, fountaining upward into the rigging. Yet the dulcet tones of petty officers gently encouraged them to be still speedier.
Aloft, topgallant yardmen!
The fresh command came almost before they'd finished collecting in the tops, and sent them scurrying still higher, swarming up to the level of the topmast cap.
Man topgallant and mast ropes!
More seamen moved to their stations at deck level, manning the ropes run through leading blocks on deck, then through blocks hooked to one side of each topmast cap, and down through bronze sheaves set into the squared-off heels of the topgallant masts. Each mast rope then ran up its mast once more, to the other side of the topmast cap and a securing eyebolt. The result was a line rigged through the topgallant mast heel designed to support the mast's weight as it slid down from above and controlled by the deck party assigned to each mast. Other hands eased the topmast stays and shrouds, loosening them slightly, and the next command rang out.
Haul taut!
Tension came on the mast ropes, and the officer in charge of each mast examined his own responsibility critically, then raised his hand to signal readiness.
Sway and unfid!
Seamen threw still more weight onto the mast ropes, and high above the deck, each topmast rose slightly as the rope rove through its heel, lifted it from below. Its heel rose just far enough through the square hole, just barely large enough to allow the heel to move in it, in the topmast trestle trees for a waiting hand to extract the fid, the tapered hardwood pin, which normally passed through the heel and rested on the trestle trees to support the topgallant's weight and lock it in place.
Lower away together!
The topgallant masts slid smoothly, gracefully down in almost perfect unison, as the men on the mast ropes obeyed the command. Breaching lines and heel ropes both guided and restrained the masts, although the anchorage was sheltered enough, even with the brisk breeze, that there was no real danger of the yard going astray. The purpose of the exercise wasn't to bring the masts clear down on deck and stow them, and their downward progress ended when their heels came to a point just above the hounds on their respective lower masts. At the same time the spars came down, the top men tended to the topgallant rigging. They eased the stays and backstays carefully as the masts descended, then secured them on the topmast caps. If the topgallants had been going to remain struck for any period of time, a capstan bar would have been pushed through the secured stays and lashed into place to help keep things under control. No one bothered with that particular refinement this afternoon, however. There wasn't much point, since all hands knew they were to enjoy the pleasure of completing the evolution at least 3 more times before the day was over.
"Lay down from aloft!"
The order brought the topman back down, even as a heavy lashing was passed through the fid hole and secured around the topmast to hold it in place. The ship looked truncated with her topgallant masts and topmasts doubled that way, but the topgallant was securely stowed in a manner which reduced the height of her rigging by almost a third. The result was to reduce wind resistance aloft and to reduce her rigging's center of gravity, which might well prove the margin between survival and destruction in the teeth of a winter storm. The last line was passed, the last lashing secured, and all hands watched tensely as the captain and the admiral surveyed their handiwork. It was a moment of intense stillness, a sort of hushed watchfulness, burnished by the sounds of wind and wave, the whistles of wyverns and the cries of gulls. Then Earl Thirsk looked at Rysando and nodded gravely. No one was foolish enough to cheer at the evidence of the admiral's satisfaction. Even the pressed men of the ship's company had been aboard long enough to learn better than that. But there were broad grins here and there, born of combined relief. None of them had wanted to consider how the captain would react if they'd embarrassed him in front of the admiral, and pride, the knowledge that they'd done well. Completing an evolution like this in harbor was child's play compared to accomplishing it at sea, in the dark, in a pitching, rolling vessel. Most of them knew that. Some, the relatively small number of seasoned seamen scattered amongst them, from intensely unpleasant personal experience. But they also knew it was something they were going to have to do eventually. None of them were any more enamored of the notion of sweating for the sake of sweating than the next man, but the majority of them preferred to master the necessary skills here rather than trying to pick them up at the last minute in the face of a potentially life-or-death emergency at sea. That was an unusual attitude in many ways, especially for crews which contained such large percentages of inexperienced landsmen. Sailors who'd been snapped up by the press gangs tended to resent being dragged away from their snug homes ashore and from wives and children who depended upon them for support. Given the risks of battle, not to mention the vagaries of disease or accident, the odds were little better than even that they would ever see those wives and children again. That was enough to break any husband or father's heart. But it didn't even consider the fact that their impressment generally rendered their families destitute overnight. There was no guarantee the ones they loved would manage to survive in their men's absence. And even if they did, hardship and hunger were all but guaranteed for most of them. Under the circumstances, it was scarcely surprising that, more often than not, pressed men had to be driven to their tasks, frequently with calculated brutality, until they fused into a cohesive ship's company. Sometimes they never achieved that fusion at all, and even many of those who eventually would find their places simply lacked the experience, so far at least, to understand why relentless training was important to them and not simply to their demanding, hectoring officers and hard-fisted petty officers. That wasn't the sort of attitude which normally evoked cheerful eagerness for swarming up and down masts on an icy cold afternoon, when they could have been below decks out of the cutting wind. The attitude of Rockerai's company was quite different from that, however. In fact, it was different from that which would previously have been seen aboard almost any Dolaran warship with so many pressed men. Partly, that was because this time there'd been relatively little brutality, and that which had been employed had been carefully calculated, fitted to the circumstances which demanded it, and administered with ruthless equity. There'd still been at least a few incidents where it had been unnecessary, where a bosun's mate of the old school had resorted to the use of fists or the over-enthusiastic employment of his starter, a knotted length of rope used to whip laggards along. But they'd been remarkably few compared to what would have happened in most other Dolaran fleets. Partly, that was because so many of the Navy's old-school bosun's mates, and captains for that matter, had been lost in the disastrous campaign which had ended at Rock Point and Crag Hook. Mostly, though, it was because the fleet's new commander had explained his position on that particular point, among others, with crystalline clarity. And because it had turned out he'd actually meant it as well. So far, 11 captains who'd made the mistake of assuming he wasn't serious about his orders concerning unnecessary punishment or brutality had been relieved in disgrace. Given the fact that two of those captains had been even better born than the Earl, and that one of them had enjoyed the patronage of the Duke of Thrast himself, none of his remaining captains were inclined to doubt he'd meant what he said the first time. There was another reason as well, though, one that grew out of acceptance from below even more than out of restraint from above, and one which had won Earl Thirsk a degree of devotion almost unheard of among impressed seamen. No one knew exactly how word of it had gotten out, but it was common knowledge in the fleet that the Earl had personally argued that since the fleet was being manned for Mother Church's service, Mother Church ought to assume responsibility for the well-being of the pressed men's families. The wage of a common sailor in the Royal Dolaran Navy wasn't much, but Mother Church would see to it that the money was paid directly to a man's family during his absence, if that was his request. More than that, and totally unprecedented, the church had promised to pay a pension to the widow of any impressed seaman who died on active service, and to provide for the support of his minor children as well. All of which helped to explain why there were remarkably few groans of resignation as the captain and the admiral returned to Rockerai's poop deck and the captain reached for his speaking trumpet yet again.
Up, topgallant masts!
They're getting better at that than I'd really like, Sir Dominic Stainer, the Baron of Rock Point, observed quietly. The one-legged admiral leaned comfortably back in an overstuffed armchair, the wooden peg which had replaced the calf of his right leg resting on a footstool in front of him. Kraken oil lamps burned brightly, hanging from the deckhead, and the sleeping bulk of his new flagship was quiet about him as she lay at anchor while he watched the recorded imagery play out before his eyes. The lowered topgallant masts were moving back up into position as smoothly as they'd descended, as if controlled by a single hand, and he shook his head.
Agreed, Merlin Athrawus's voice replied in his right ear, speaking from his palace bedchamber in Chiraeth, the better part of 7,000 miles away. It was just past midnight in King's Harbor, but the first, very faint traces of an icy winter dawn could be seen out of Merlin's window.
Of course, it's all still drill under pretty much ideal circumstances, and they still aren't as good at it as our people are.
Maybe not, Rockpoint conceded. Then again, nobody's as good at it as our people are, and I'd just as soon keep it that way.
He shook his head again.
Proficiency builds confidence, Merlin, and the last thing we need is for these people to start feeling confident about facing us at sea.
He paused for a moment, head cocked as if in thought, then snorted.
Allow me to correct myself. The next to last thing we need is for them to start feeling confident about their competence. The last thing we need is for them to actually develop that competence. And that, unfortunately, is exactly what Thirsk seems to be doing.
Agreed, Merlin repeated, this time in something much more like a sigh. I've discovered that despite myself, I rather admire Thirsk, he continued. Still, I've also discovered that I can't quite help wishing he'd encountered a round shot at Crag Hook. For that matter, I can't help wishing King Ronald had gone ahead and had him executed as a scapegoat for Armageddon Reef. It would have been grossly unfair, but the man's entirely too good at his job for my peace of mind.
I suppose it's inevitable they could turn up at least one competent sailor if they looked long enough and hard enough, Rockpoint agreed sourly. I don't think all the time he spent on the beach hurt any either, Merlin pointed out.
Rockpoint raised an interrogative eyebrow, and Merlin grimaced.
The man's got a brain that's probably at least as good as Alfred's, he pointed out. And he's got more actual sea experience than almost anyone else the church can call on.
I think it's pretty obvious he spent the time they left him ashore to rot using that brain and that experience to analyze all the mistakes Magwer and idiots like Thorast have been making. They were stupid to park him there, and I'm just as glad they did, but the downside is that they gave him plenty of time to think. Now he's putting the fruits of all that thinking to work.
Rockpoint made an irate sound of acknowledgement, something midway between a grunt and a growl. Like Merlin and Caleb, the Baron had come to the conclusion that Thirsk was almost certainly Karras's most dangerous current adversary. As Merlin had just pointed out, the man had a brain, and a dangerously competent one. Worse, he wasn't a bit afraid of what Merlin called thinking outside the box. His insistence that the church provide for the families of impressed seamen was unheard of, for example. There'd been bitter resistance to the entire notion, and not just from the church. Quite a few of the Dolaran Navy's senior officers had mounted a ferocious attempt to defeat the suggestion. Some of that resistance had been pure reflex in defense of the way things have always been. Some of it had stemmed from a fear that the practice would become customary, that the Navy would be expected to assume the same financial responsibilities in the future. But more of it had arisen from simple resentment of the authority and support which both the Duke of Fern and Captain General Magwer had thrown behind Thirsk, and from Thirsk's willingness to use that support to smash his way through their sullen resistance. Reformers were seldom beloved, and the degree to which they were resented and loathed was usually in direct proportion to how desperately reform was needed. There's a lesson there, Merlin reflected, or a damned sharp bit of irony at any rate, given how unpopular reformers like Caleb Armok and Michael Stainer are proving in the temple just now.
You realize, the Baron said after a second or two, if he actually manages to get their navy reorganized for them, Thorast and the others will toss him out to the Krakens just as soon as they figure they can possibly get along without him.
Of course they will, Merlin agreed a trifle sadly. I think he knows it too, which only makes him even more dangerous from our perspective.
So we'll just have to do something about him ourselves, Rockpoint said more briskly. Gwilym's about ready to sail.
I know, Merlin frowned. In a lot of ways, though, I wish you were going instead.
Gwilym's just as capable as I am, Rockpoint pointed out.
There might have been a touch of stiffness in his tone, and Merlin shook his head quickly.
It's not a matter of capabilities, Dominic, he said. Believe me, no one has more respect for Gwilym than I do. It's just that I'd rather the fellow in charge of singeing King Ronald's beard had access to the Snarks. especially given how competent we've just agreed Thirsk is turning out to be. Rockpoint nodded in acknowledgement, although the acknowledgement in question was obviously a bit grudging. Still, he really couldn't argue the point. Admiral Sir Gwilym Manthir had been Caleb's flag captain at the battles of Rockpoint, Crag Hook, and Darko Sound. He was an experienced seaman, possessed of a singular attention to detail and an iron nerve. He was not, however, one of the inner circle who had been cleared for the truth about Merlin, which meant he wasn't going to be examining any satellite imagery, nor, for that matter, would anyone assigned to his staff. Unfortunately, Rockpoint himself was the only one of Caleb and Charlian's senior naval officers who was part of the inner circle. Getting some of the others on board was a high priority, but, again, not something which could be rushed. Rockpoint himself had argued strongly in favor of adding High Admiral Brian Locke Island to the list, and both he and Merlin were confident that the Brethren of St. Journeau would approve Locke Island's admission quite soon. Of course, the question then arose of just who would inform Locke Island. With Caleb, Charlian, and Archbishop Michael all out of Old Karras, it would be virtually impossible to find the right messenger, somebody with the authority to make Locke Island listen if he didn't take it well, and somebody he'd trust enough to believe when he did listen. Baron Wave Thunder might serve in a case of dire emergency, but still.
"I could probably talk Brian into sending me instead of Gwilym," the Baron said after a moment, but his expression was unhappy and his tone was tentative. "No," Merlin shook his head again. "Caleb and Charlian are right about that. We need you right where you are, too, or rather where you're about to be. And let's face it, Dolar's a worry, but Taro's right next door, and White Ford is no slouch either." It was Rockpoint's turn to grimace, but he couldn't disagree. The Imperial Carizian Navy was the largest, most powerful fleet any single Safeholdian realm had ever boasted. It was rising rapidly to a strength of over 90 galleons, and it continued to expand. Unfortunately, it wasn't going to find itself matched against any other single Safeholdian realm. It was going to face the combined fleets of virtually every mainland realm. Worse, the Church of God Awaiting had poured out staggering sums to subsidize those fleets, although not all of the various kingdoms and empires' building programs were equally advanced. The Temple Lands and the more northern ports of the Harchong Empire were considerably behind the shipyards of Dolar and the Desnarian Empire. But that situation wasn't going to improve for the Church anytime soon. But the plain ugly truth was that even with an unlimited budget, which it didn't have, the Carizian Empire couldn't possibly have matched the mainland realm's combined building capacity. Nor was the Carizian supply of manpower unlimited either. 90 galleons, each with a crew of roughly 500, required 45,000 men. So far, the Navy had managed to meet its manpower requirements without resorting to impressment of its own, largely because it had always followed policies similar to the ones Thirsk had forced upon Dolar and the Church. That was about to change, however, because there were only so many volunteers who could be attracted, no matter what the inducement, and the manning situation was only going to get worse as the size of the fleet continued to climb. And it was going to have to climb. Assuming the Church completed its current construction programs, it would command a fleet of over 390 galleons, better than four times the current Carizian strength. 150 of them would be converted merchant ships, but so were a quarter of the Carizian Navy's galleons. And that didn't even consider the 200-plus galleys the Church had built before it realized just how outclassed galleys had become. They might not be well-suited to decisive broadside duels, but they more than doubled the total number of hulls the Church could throw at its opponents,
And if they were free to operate while the church's galleons neutralized Karis's galleons, the good news was that the ships in question were scattered between five widely separated navies. No single kingdom or empire could match the Carizian's numbers, although Harchong would come close once its winter-delayed construction could be completed. Concentrating those widely dispersed squadrons would be at least as difficult as it had been to concentrate the forces detailed for the Group of Four's original plans for Old Karis's destruction. And even after they were concentrated, their companies would be sadly inexperienced compared to the Imperial Navy's crews. Earl Thirsk, at least, obviously recognized that fact. So did Gavin Martin, the Baron of Whiteford, King Gorja of Taro's senior admiral. Unfortunately, from the Church's perspective, there were only two fleet commanders still available to it who had ever faced the Carizian Navy in battle. The Earl of Blackwater, the Coruscantian commander at Darko Sound, had died there, and Garth Ralston, the Earl of Mandir, and Sir Luke Coleman, the Earl of Sharpfield, who had commanded the Emeraldian and the Chisomian components of Blackwater's fleet, were now in Carizian service. Even more unfortunately for the Church, the fact that Thirsk and Whiteford had been devastatingly defeated by then Crown Prince Caleb had caused their advice to be discounted by almost all of their fellow flag officers. That was clearly changing in Thirsk's case, but neither Harchong nor the Desnarian Empire nor the Temple Lands seemed overly inclined to profit by Dolar's example. Taro did, but King Gorja continued to languish under a cloud of disapproval. It seemed clear that the Group of Four continued to blame Taro for the disastrous intelligence leak, which had permitted King Harald of Karis and his son to deduce the Church's strategy and come up with a counter-strategy to defeat it in detail. That was grossly unfair, although with no knowledge of Merlin's snarks, it was understandable enough, particularly given Karis's efforts to encourage exactly that reaction. As a consequence, none of the Church's galley fleet had been laid down in Taroisian shipyards. Following the Group of Four's belated switch to a galleon-based fleet, Taro had been admitted to the building program, yet even then the Taroisian component remained the smallest of all. And Whiteford, who was quite possibly an even better combat commander than Thirsk, had been almost totally ignored. Under the circumstances, the Church's numerical advantage was considerably less overwhelming than it might appear. To set against that, however, the Empire of Karis was a very large, very vulnerable target. Karis and Chisholm, in particular, were 6,000 miles apart as the Wyvern flew, and it was over 2,000 miles from Port Royal, in Chisholm, to Coruscant's Cape Targon. A ship deployed to defend Karis was a minimum of a month from Chisholm under even the most favorable conditions of wind and weather, and it would take almost that long for a ship stationed in Chisholm to reach Manchir in Coruscant. Distances and transit times like that prevented High Admiral Lock Island from concentrating his own forces in a central position. In fact, he'd been forced to station 20 galleons in Chisholm under Admiral Sharpfield and supported by the Chisomian Navy's surviving galleys. Another 10 galleons and 25 galleys had been stationed in Coruscantian waters under Earl Mandir, and Lock Island had retained 20 galleons under his own command, covering Rockshoal Bay and the approaches to Howell Bay and the Sea of Karis. That left barely 40 galleons for other service, and freeing up even that many had been possible only because the Church's war fleet was so widely scattered, and still so far short of completion. As more of the Church's galleons became available for service, the various Carizian defensive fleets would have to be strengthened, which would reduce the strength available for other tasks still further. Unless something could be done in the meantime to reduce the numbers opposed to them. That was supposed to be Manthir's and Rockpoint's assignment. Manthir, with 18 galleons and 6,000 marines, was bound for the Sea of Harchong. More specifically, he was bound for Hardship Bay on the largely uninhabited Claw Island. There were reasons very few people lived on Claw Island. It wasn't very big, barely 112 miles in its longest dimension. It was also little more than 200 miles south of the equator, and its barren, mostly treeless expanses of rock and sand were about as welcome as an oven the same size. On the other hand, Hardship Bay offered a good deep-water anchorage, and the small city of Claw Keep would offer his squadron a home port, of sorts, at any rate. Even more importantly, it was better than 21,000 sea miles from Telisburg, which put it barely 5,000 sea miles from Garath Bay. It also lay off the western coast of South Harchong, however, where a quarter of the Harchong Empire's galleons were under construction, and it was less than 1,500 miles from the mouth of the Gulf of Dolar. The voyage to Claw Island would actually have been slightly shorter if he sailed east by way of Chisholm, instead of west past Armageddon Reef and around the southern tip of the continent of Howard. But he'd have both favorable winds and currents going west, especially this time of year. He'd probably average at least 50 or 60 miles more a day on his projected course, and it would still take him better than 3 months to complete the voyage. Once he got there, his marines ought to be more than sufficient to capture Claw Keep and garrison the island, especially since the only reliable source of water on the entire sun-blasted spit were the artesian wells that served Claw Keep itself. That would provide him with a secure base from which to operate against both Dolar and Harchong. He'd be a long way from home, although he'd be within 9,000 miles of Chisholm, but he'd be well placed to blockade the Gulf of Dolar and intercept any effort to combine Thirsk's galleons with the Harchongese contingent building farther south around Shipwreck Bay in the provinces of Quiroz, Kiznetsov, and Selkar. Even if he did nothing but sit there, and Merlin was confident that an officer of Manthir's abilities and personality should find all manner of ways to make himself an infuriating pest, it was unlikely the Church, or King Ronald or Emperor Waisu, for that matter, would be prepared to tolerate a Carizian presence that close to them. His galleons would be substantially outnumbered by almost 4-1 by Dolar alone, assuming the Dolarans got all of their own warships completed and manned. But the greater experience of his crews and captains would offset much of that disadvantage. And the simple fact that Karras was once again taking the initiative, despite its numerical disadvantage, would have profound implications for the confidence and morale of his opponents. And if worse came to worst, he could always load his marines back aboard his transports and withdraw. That's the idea, at least, Merlin thought. And as a way to throw a spanner into the Church's plans, it's got a lot to recommend it. But I'd still feel better with Dominic in command. Or if we could give Gwilym a calm, at least. I hate having that big a chunk of the Navy out at the end of a limb that long when we can't even talk to its CO. Unfortunately, as he himself had just pointed out, they were going to need Rock Point closer to home. He and the remaining 20 galleons currently available to Karras would be moving their base of operations to Hanthtown on Margaret Bay, which would put him across the Trangier Passage from the Kingdom of Taro. His new base would be well placed to assist Lock Island in meeting any threat against Old Karras from East Haven or Desnair. More importantly, however, he'd be in a position to operate directly against Taro. And Charlian was right about that, too, Merlin reflected. It's more important than ever to induce Gorja to consider joining the Empire voluntarily. Or, failing that, to present him with a somewhat more forceful argument. Neutralizing Taro would be worthwhile in its own right. Gaining Taro as a forward base right off the East Haven coast
would be even more worthwhile, and getting our hands on the galleons Gorgia's building for the church wouldn't hurt a damned thing either. I'd like to be able to do a lot of things we can't do right now, he said out loud. Desnair's starting to worry me, for one thing, and I really wish we could get at Harchong and the Temple Lands Yards. But we can't afford to uncover old Karras and Chisholm, and that's just the way it is. If Gwilym can keep Dolar busy long enough for you and Grey Harbor to convince Gorgia to see the light, it'll help a lot, though.
Then we'll just have to see what we can do about that, won't we, Sage and Merlin? Rockpoint said with a smile. We'll just have to see what we can do.
5. City of Fairstock, Province of Malensoth, West Harchong Empire. The falling snow was so thick, no one could see more than a ship's length or two in any direction. The Earl of Corus found that less than reassuring as Snow Lizard crept cautiously into the Fairstock roadstead. Captain Euthane had furled his sail and gone to oars as soon as the leadsman in the bow found bottom at 10 fathoms. 60 feet represented considerably more depth of water than Snow Lizard required, but only a fool, which Euthane had conclusively demonstrated he was not, took liberties with the Fairstock Channel. It measured the next best thing to 250 miles from north to south, and if most of it was easily navigable, there were other bits which were anything but, and there wasn't a lot of room to spare. At its narrowest point, which also happened to offer some of the nastiest shifting sandbanks, it was barely 14 miles wide at high water. Fairstock Bay itself was a superbly sheltered anchorage, well over 200 miles wide, but getting into it could sometimes prove tricky, especially in the middle of a snowstorm. Frankly, Corus would have preferred to lay to off the entrance of the channel until the weather cleared. Unfortunately, there was no guarantee the weather would clear any time soon, and Captain Euthane was under orders to deliver his passenger to Fairstock as quickly as possible. So he'd crept very cautiously and slowly inshore until he'd been able to run a line of soundings which let him locate himself by matching them with the depths recorded on his chart. Even after he was confident he knew where he was, however, he'd continued to proceed with a caution of which Corus had wholeheartedly approved. Not only was it distinctly possible, in these visibility conditions, that Snow Lizard wasn't really where he thought she was, but there was always the equally unpleasant possibility that they might meet another vessel head-on. The narrowness of the channel and the atrocious visibility only made that even more likely, and Philip Osgood hadn't come this far at the summons of the Council of Vicars just to get himself drowned or frozen to death.
By the mark, 7 fathom!
The cry floated back from the bow, oddly muffled and deadened by the falling snow, and despite his thick coat and warm gloves, Corus shivered.
I imagine you'll be happy to get ashore, my lord, Captain Euthane remarked, and Corus turned to face him quickly.
He'd been careful not to intrude on the captain's concentration, while Euthane conned Snow Lizard cautiously up channel. It wasn't the sort of moment at which one joggled someone's elbow, he reflected. Something of his thoughts must have shown in his expression, because Euthane grinned through his beard.
This next little bit's not all that bad, my lord, he said. I wouldn't want to sound overconfident, but I'd say the really tricky parts are all safely past us. Not but what I imagine there was a time or two when you were less than confident we'd get this far.
Nonsense, Captain. Corus shook his head with an answering smile. I never doubted your seamanship or the quality of your ship and crew for a moment.
Ah, now, Euthane shook his head. It's kind of you to be saying so, but I'm not so sure telling a fearful lie like that is good for the health of your soul, my lord.
If it were a lie, perhaps it wouldn't be good for my spiritual health. Since it happens to have been a completely truthful statement, however, I'm not especially concerned, Captain.
Euthane chuckled, then cocked his head, listening to the leadsman's fresh announcement of the depth. He frowned thoughtfully down at the chart, obviously fixing his position afresh in his brain, and Corus watched him with the respect a professional deserved. As it happened, what he'd just said to Euthane really had been the truth. On the other hand, despite his recognition of the captain's skill and the capability of his crew, there'd been more than one moment when Corus had strongly doubted they would ever reach Fairstock. The Gulf of Dolar in winter had proved even uglier than he'd feared, and once they'd cleared the passage between Cliff Island and Whale Island, they'd encountered a howling gale which he'd been privately certain was going to pound the low-slung, frail, shoal-draft galley bodily under. The steep, battering seas had been almost as high as the galley's mast, and at one point they'd been forced to lie to a sea anchor for 2 full days, with the pumps continuously manned. There'd been no hot food for those 2 days, not even Euthane's cook had been able to keep his galley fire lit, and icy water had swirled ankle-deep through the Earl's cabin more than once as the ship fought for her very life. They'd survived that particular crisis after all, yet that had scarcely been the end of the foul weather, or the crises they'd faced. Snow, bad visibility, and icy rigging had only made things still worse, and Corus's respect for Euthane and his men had grown with each passing day. Despite which, he could hardly wait to get off the ship. It would have been tiresome enough to spend an entire month in such confined quarters under any circumstances. Under the conditions associated with a winter passage of the Gulf, tiresome had quickly given way to something much closer to intolerable.
Of course, there is the little fact that every foot closer to Fairstock brings me that much closer to Zion and the Temple as well, he reminded himself. On the other hand, as the Archangel Bedard said, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. If I get off this damned ship alive, I'll be perfectly prepared to let future problems take care of themselves.
I make it about another 3 hours to our anchorage, my lord, Euthane said, re-emerging from his contemplation of the chart. If the visibility were better, we'd probably already have a pilot boat coming alongside. As it is, I won't be so very surprised if we have to feel our way all the way in on our own. Either way, though, I think we'll have you ashore in time for supper.
I appreciate that, Captain. I doubt anyone could have taken better care of me on the passage than you have, but I trust I won't offend you if I admit I'd really like to sleep in a bed that isn't moving tonight, he grimaced. I doubt I'll get more than one night, maybe two if I'm really lucky, but I intend to enjoy it to the fullest.
Well, I can't say as I blame you, Euthane said. Mind you, I've never really understood why anyone prefers sleeping ashore when he's the option. Although, to be honest, back before I had my own cabin and my own cot, I felt rather differently about it, I believe. Fortunately for my sea dog image, he grinned at his passenger again. That's been long enough ago now that my memory's none too clear.
I'm sure that for a seasoned sailor like yourself, the ship's motion is just like a mother rocking a cradle, Corus responded. Still, though, I think it's an acquired taste. And if it's all the same to you, it's one I'd just as soon not acquire.
To each his own, my lord, Euthane agreed equably.
As it happened, Euthane's prediction was accurate. They had to make their own way until they saw the blurred, indistinct shapes of other vessels riding at anchor, and dropped their own anchor. In fact, they'd passed close enough aboard one of the other ships to draw an irate shout of warning from its anchor watch.
"Oh, hold your noise!" Euthane had bellowed back through his speaking trumpet. "This is an emperor ship on church business! Besides, if I'd wanted to sink your sorry ass, you silly bastard, I'd have hit you square amidships, not passed across your misbegotten bow!"
The noise from the other vessel had ended abruptly, and Euthane had winked at Corus.
"Truth to tell, my lord," he'd admitted in a much lower voice,
I never even saw them until the last moment. I think I'm as surprised as they are that I didn't cut their cable. Not that I'd ever admit it to them, even under torture.
Your secret's safe with me, Captain, Corus had assured him, then gone below to be certain Sea Blanket had everything packed up to go ashore.
I've checked and double-checked, my lord, the habitually gloomy-faced valet had said to him. Still and all, I don't doubt I've forgotten something, or misplaced it, or that one of Captain Euthane's sticky-fingered sailors has relieved us of it when I wasn't looking.
I promise I won't hold you responsible for someone else's pilferage, Robert, Corus had assured him.
If the promise had done anything to lighten Sea Blanket's gloom, Corus hadn't noticed it. On the other hand, his valet knew their itinerary as well as he did, and he rather doubted Sea Blanket was any more eager than he was for the final stage of the journey. Now, as the Earl sat on the midship's thwart of the 10-oared launch which had, eventually, turned up to ferry him ashore, he found his own thoughts dwelling on the prospect of the journey in question. He was by nature a less gloomy fellow than Sea Blanket, but at the moment he'd discovered his mood was very much in tune with the valet's. The one good thing about the weather was that there was very little wind, yet that didn't keep an open boat from feeling like Shan Wei's own ice house, and he felt confident the bitter cold he was feeling at the moment was only a mild foreshadowing of what it was going to be like when they reached Lake Pei.
Or, for that matter, how cold it's going to be between here and Lake Pei, he told himself sourly. Langhorne, I hope I really do get at least 2 nights in a row under a roof in a warm bed that isn't simultaneously pitching and rolling under me.
Easy all,
the launch's coxswain called.
In oars, and bear off forward there, Andy.